Yes, I'm rolling, I'm sorry.
Somewhere on there, it had something about contact with war and conflict.
Yeah, yeah.
And as we were, those 2 years I was there was sort of a lull between the leaving of the French. But when I went there, there was a sizable USAM mission, the AIDS assistance program. And there was also 500 U.S. military, as an example to what it was then to what it became.
Oh, yeah.
And these 500 military were only advisors and were not allowed to carry firearms.
And probably very close in with capitals and provincial towns and stuff.
And as far as activity, there wasn't, there was skirmishes or incidents here and there, and I think like 20 teachers or village leaders were killed a week out here and there.
Yeah.
It didn't, it didn't come close to me except one time when the town, I got word that the town of Jierling, which is, was the next town up the road towards Dalat.
I think you mentioned that town already, yeah.
That's the Francis Lay one.
Yeah.
So I think it was, I don't think he was there at the time. It was taken over by the Viet Cong. The administration, they just took it over, and then after 3 days they left, just like a show of power. Another time, the workers at the farm that I'd been were talking about the Viet Cong up there doing mountains.
They're up there.
Not that far. I mean, this is like from here to the capital. Not that far. A mountain. Low mountain, and that there were some communist people, guerrillas up there. And these are northerners now. These left their home in the north and came down probably with their priests and a family in a village group that fell down there because they didn't want to live under communism. So I said, well, what would you do if they came to Balak?
Yeah.
And they say, well, we'd move away, we'd move further south. And I said, well, what would you do if they came to that place? And they said, we'd go to Saigon. And, well, what would you do if they came to Saigon? We'd go to the water and walk into the water. To the ocean.
Yeah, yeah.
Walk our families into the ocean. That's how strongly they felt. And I thought I was on the right side. I was quite naive politically when I went over there, and I probably still am, but I thought what the U.S. was doing was the right thing as
well. Well, I don't think it was necessarily, well, we could go all day on that, but certainly from the perspective of these people, because they had been personally persecuted. Same way down in the Delta with the Waho and the Kaodai, who were also persecuted by, and didn't want any Vietnamese government, per se, because they had their own thing. They didn't want any part of a northern, of a communist experience. And I've had folks who were stationed in a Waho area, the Buddhist sect of Waho, kind of its own little splinter group and had its own little army.
Yes, but weren't they, was that a Buddhist group or were they like gangsters?
This is not the Binh Xuan.
Oh, that's the gangster.
Yeah, that's the gangster. Yeah, someone who was in the Waho area would say that whenever a Viet Cong would be trying to infiltrate to spread some propaganda or just to take a look at the situation for intelligence, they'd find him and be a floating body. Yeah. So, you know, certainly from those perspectives, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, the war was on the right side. Too bad it wasn't simply that straightforward all the time, you know, and so many other places. Good, I'm glad you did discuss that, because you did say that toward the end of your time, travel became a little more difficult. In what sense?
When I first went there, for a year and a half, we could, we, I could, I went wherever I wanted. I had either a Jeep or a Land Rover parked mm-hmm. outside where I was living. And if we wanted, if I wanted to go to Bonnetouit for the weekend, I'd go to Bonnetouit or to
take the highway.
Yeah.
And now check with
the Kinder Peace, which is another experience. So
with the cross the
line? In French, it's Peace de Kinda, and Vietnamese called it Kinder Peace. Dirt road through the jungle to get uh-huh. from this Bao Lac is on Quoc Loi
mm-hmm.
rural route 20.
Mm-hmm.
And Bonnetouit is over toward the Laotian border.
Yeah.
You have, so to get across, you had to go through the mountains
mm-hmm.
and through the jungle. And in some of the places, what I referred to before, is where they were bulldozing the jungle and bringing in coastal people to populate the highlands and grow crops.
Yeah.
So you go through all that area. And beautiful, wonderful area to see groups of montagnards traveling along with their back, their baskets on the back, and their coupes and spears and crossbows.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I would give them rides
yeah.
and buy what I could.
Mm-hmm.
I have some wonderful...
Of the coupes and the war...
And the little knives and,
yeah.
and headdresses. And I, well, on my trip into the jungle on the cacao expedition, I would buy sarongs and loincloths and blankets and all kinds of paraphernalia,
uh-huh.
more than I needed.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept what I wanted, and the excess I take to Saigon when we'd have monthly team meetings or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it also got that the montagnard would come to my door and sell me blankets and armor when I was interested. And I eventually got, and I would sell them to other team people who wanted to buy them, or other U.S. community. Some of the USAM people were interested in buying them, and I got the name Hungarian Rug Merchant because they knew my, of this Italian-Hungarian mixture.
Right,
I favor the Hungarian
uh-huh.
ethnicity.
Uh-huh.
My sister is the Italian ethnicity. She's 15 years in Italy. And so there was a Hungarian rug merchant, and that I mentioned before, because of the cacao, working with the cacao, another nickname I got was Bobby Cacao.
Yes, you did say that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here comes a Hungarian rug merchant. What was I talking about?
But security, basically you could...
Oh, yeah, I could go anywhere I wanted.
Because later I think people, I heard that what you would do is you would find the bus driver. You know, as the bus is sitting in the town, waiting for people and stuff, you'd ask the bus driver, have there been buses that have come in from some other place?
Mm-hmm.
Because that meant that the road is open. If nothing's come in, you don't go up.
Yeah, well, this was even before that.
Even before
you didn't
that?
Have to worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
But by the second Christmas,
mm-hmm.
this is Christmas 1989 and
uh-huh.
the year 1960. We, as a team, decided to have Christmas together in Dalat, where Ray Wharton was and had his wonderful French villa up on the hill.
I've seen it. I've seen photographs of it and such.
And then
description right next to Madame New's house.
Yes, down the right.
Which was later trashed.
Was it?
Yeah. Because I spoke to somebody who was in the Dalat house after the assassination of Diem and when Madame New had fled and
mm-hmm.
the window. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm sorry. You were saying the Christmas bash was going to be.
Yeah, we celebrated Christmas, and then as a group we were going to do a little holiday. We were going to divide into two groups.
Mm-hmm.
One would drive from Dalat to Hue.
Mm-hmm.
And the other group would fly from Dalat to Hue.
Uh-huh.
And then we rented bicycles and did all the tombs,
mm-hmm.
which was a wonderful thing to do. All the emperor's tombs.
Yeah, around this way area.
And of course the citadel itself
mm-hmm.
was outstanding. And then at the end of the week, or however long a few days it was, the group that drove up would fly back, and the group that flew up would drive back.
Hmm.
Well, the U.S. USAM got word of this, and we didn't know we weren't supposed to do it, but at that time, security was getting worse, and we all had to write apology notes to the head of USCON or whatever for doing this and swearing that we wouldn't do it again, do that again. And what that was travel without permission, before driving without permission.
Had you ever been informed that you had to do this?
I wasn't aware of it, no. No, I don't know. I'm sure no one else was, or else we wouldn't have done it without first getting permission.
I think I would have written a very nasty apology.
No, it was very nice. Anyway, from then on, if we went, it was supposedly to call ahead or somehow get, I don't even remember how it was, we would get permission. Like if I would go up to Dalak again for the weekend, or across the Manmatuatan exchange fees or something, or down to Saigon, I would have to get permission.
Wow.
So that was about the last 6 months. Well, a little longer.
Yeah, it had longer, but because that would be about 10 months, maybe a little more or less. Because you were in country, this is not part of your form also, because you were in country during the presidency of Nguyen Phu Diem, can you tell me what your impressions of the South Vietnamese government and administration were at that particular time?
I thought Nguyen Phu Diem was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was doing a great job. His government, his government was pretty good, but the government made up of individuals and some, when they get a position, get arrogant. But I admired, Jim was Catholic and I'm Catholic, and I've left that out of, what went into making me Bob Alaska. And I was very religious and still think I am.
Uh-huh.
And he was a very strong Catholic, so that I had an admiration for him because of that. And he was, I think he was the right man for that job. I know you read in books and a lot of criticism of him. He went down the drain after he was gotten rid of.
Yes, most certainly.
And I don't know if it wouldn't have anyway. It probably would have, because I guess we were on the wrong track.
Yeah, well, that's again speculative, and we'd have to redo history, which is impossible. If we go off into speculation, we could wind up like being sociologists.
Yeah, but I was very disappointed when I found out he was assassinated.
Yeah, yeah.
And Cabot Lodge's involvement.
Anything about his uncles? I think you were...
Especially that Cabot Lodge was from a great family in Connecticut.
Really? I thought they were Bostonians.
Lodge. Oh, maybe you're right, but let me see.
That would let you off the hook.
Yeah, no, I think he was from Connecticut.
Oh, really? Okay. All right.
You can check that later.
Yeah. No. okay, so that's new. And by the way, I share some of your feelings, because I've done my own look at even the, at least all the, pause for a second. I might turn this thing on again.
Mm-hmm.
But I was talking about Diem and how there was an assassination attempt on him sometime, and I think it was up in Bamako.
I don't recall. Do you remember
somewhere in the highlands? Somewhere in the highlands, I believe.
Do you remember the year?
I'm trying to remember, but I think it was close to the time of your arrival.
Yeah.
Just a little bit before.
And then after that, I think he got very cautious, and there's a big word I can't think of that expresses what entrenched, and maybe somewhat ruthless and clamped down.
Yeah, he did seem to, even the diplomatic correspondence towards 57 and so, and I'd have to read a little bit into 58, talked about him being more inward, not as trusting, and willing to go among the crowds as he had before.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a failed assassination. It was very clumsy, but it was like his naivete had been stripped from him anyhow. My God, they could kill me. They could kill me,
I don't remember too much about that.
Yeah, but there certainly was this turn inward, and particularly with his brother. Was there, was there any perception on your part that the brother might have been the evil twin brother?
Yes.
Even at that time?
Yes, and Madame New was, there's a song I was thinking about Madame New, but she was not liked.
Even
by
at that
the people.
If by the people.
It was my perception, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, that was an unfortunate thing waiting to happen. So tell me a little bit about, and this is, well, no, let me first ask, do you have a favorite story that you like to tell of that era, when you get together on occasion at some of the reunions that we talk about, you know, that we talked about before the tape, some, you know, especially when you would get together with Brockmuller or Luce or people that were over at the same time, is there any particular story that sticks out in your mind?
Well, the one that sticks out in my mind, I've already told you about, about the refugees, moving from the communists, walking into the ocean.
Okay.
But that's not a funny story. And I don't know if I can...
Well, it wouldn't necessarily have to be funny to be favorite. You know, it could be a close encounter with, you know, a guerrilla group. It could be, you know, a touching moment with a close friend, et cetera.
Yeah,
but it, you know, if that's the thing that sticks out in your mind, mm-hmm. the dedication that those folks had to avoid the communist influence.
This is not a particular story, but... on these trips in amongst the mob,
mm-hmm.
it was usually someone else besides Lewandowski, and sometimes I go myself without Lewandowski. But there were, let me say most, and at that time again, there was probably no more than a dozen
mm-hmm.
people on the team. But most of them would want to, at some time or other, would want to come on the trip just for the experience.
Oh, your fellow team members who might have been assigned elsewhere.
Yes, Brockmuller, for instance.
Yeah.
He was a great hunter.
Mm-hmm.
He would bring his rifle and come.
Oh, really?
And they pop off deer.
Uh-huh.
I don't think they ever got a tiger. But that's my favorite story. But anyway, each time one or two would come along. And one time, I don't know who it was, but the son who was visiting his family in Saigon, who worked for the mission, Busan Mission Aid, knew Lewandowski and came with us on one of the mission visits. It was, you know, a great thing for him.
Sure.
Lewandowski's son visited one time, and he came on a trip.
Uh-huh.
Well, I'll tell you, there's something that happened after I moved to the... onto the, and I say the campus of the school, but this is a very rustic campus. I mean,
uh-huh.
dirt road and not lawns, but fields of tall grass here and there. I mean, and I was on sort of the outskirts, the edge, where the main building was. They cut the grass with sickles.
One room, one floor kind of thing with the
ceiling.
Yeah, a line of rooms with the. The front awning in the front, you wouldn't have rooms facing each other to hold the heat.
No, my where I lived, as I said before, was originally made for graduate students.
Right.
And there were some graduate students in them, but there'd be duplexes, which meant two units of three rooms attached.
Uh-huh.
And then there'd be another two units of three rooms and two units of three rooms, and they were three when I was there, and I understand later they built three more on the other side. Well, on the other side of the dirt road, I mean, just like across the street, this one Saturday, students had gathered. They set up picnic tables,
uh-huh.
and they put some kind of a canvas plastic awning over the table. And then there was a, there was a group of about 25 or 30, and I'm looking out, what are they doing? And mm-hmm. what they're doing is they're having a dog barbecue.
Mm-hmm.
They had gone to the market and bought a dog,
mm-hmm.
and it was a spotted, it was, oh, it was about a little bit like a shepherd dog that chased the sheep around with a mm-hmm. Black and white dog. And I went over, and they asked me to join in, and I watched the whole procedure. They tied the dog's paws behind its back, front and back. They slit its throat. They bled it. They threw the carcass onto a fire to burn the fur off. They opened it up. They took the insides out. They chopped it up into little pieces and put it into a stew pot. And then after it cooked an hour or so, we sat down and had dog.
Uh-huh.
Another time, I got word that someone had killed a tiger down the road.
Oh.
And that he was selling meat
mm-hmm.
from the tiger. So I said, yeah, I never had tiger meat. I didn't really want any, but just for the experience.
Say you
Bao,
got it.
I think it was Bao. We changed around the interpreter sometimes. And we got in the Jeep, and we went down to where this was, and it was like 10 miles away. And sure enough, there he was. He had this tiger all cut up and open on the ground in a field.
Uh-huh.
And we bought a kilo or so and brought it home. And other than Bao, I had a cook. Now that's another story. So anyway, I didn't have to cook it. I gave it to the cook.
Yeah.
And he cooked it.
Mm-hmm.
But the first cook I had, Bao and I went into a neighboring village. And he asked around if anybody was looking for a job to be a cook for this American down at school. And then he had this one guy, I don't even remember if there were more than one, but we talked to this one man who was had been in the French army, or when the French were there in the
mm-hmm.
army,
mm-hmm.
as a cook. And I hired him. I hired him. Came and he lived in the cook shack behind the house and went back to the village once a week or so to visit his family, and sometimes the family would come and stay with him for a few days. He had a cute little girl and his wife. And in the beginning, he asked what kind of food we wanted to eat, whether we wanted to eat Vietnamese food
uh-huh.
or Western food,
uh-huh.
French food. I said, oh my God, I have a gold mine here. This guy can cook French cuisine and he could cook Vietnamese cuisine.
Uh-huh.
So I said, well, as young and naive as I was, why don't we eat French at noon and Vietnamese in the evening?
Hmm.
I mean, ask someone to make in one day, too, you know.
Wow.
Now that I think of it, it was a little much. But he agreed. Well, it wasn't too long that I got to realize that when we ate French food, we had bread,
mm.
little French rolls, and when we had Vietnamese food, we had rice.
Yeah.
All of the other food was the same. we had French bread and ate with knives and forks.
Uh-huh.
And then in the evening, we had rice and ate with chopsticks. That was
the difference
in the cuisine.
Oh, gosh. Let me pause here and look over your form one last time here. I'll put this back on.
Let's see, we were talking about, you just went back and talked about Viet Cong in relation with ASTA idea. There's one incident that made me recollect, and it's not Viet Cong and myself directly, but I became very friendly with this man and his wife and his one daughter and about six of his wife's sister's children that they were taking care of. For what reason, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
And he was an agricultural engineer at the plantation experiment station, plantation crop experiment station. We were very simpatico.
Mm-hmm.
We just clicked.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Happened.
He just quit. And I, two or three times a week, in the evening, I would go over to their, he lived on the plantation. vacation in one of those houses, but in better condition than I referred to before. And I taught English. I taught, they requested, they wanted to learn English,
yeah.
And they asked me if I could help them with English.
So you did a little bit of that too?
In the evening, three times, I think it was maybe three times a week. And there was a group of other people that worked there, and I don't know, there was about six of them. And I had a blackboard, and we had, I don't know where the books came from, but we had a language book. Anyway, one day I got word that this man was taken to Saigon or somewhere by the authorities under suspicion of being Viet Cong. He was gone, his wife was very downhearted, and I would visit and try and comfort a little bit. And eventually he was released after several weeks. And we never spoke about it.
Mm-hmm.
We never spoke about it. And then later he was transferred, he worked for the Ministry of Agriculture, being a Pacific Service Station. He was then later transferred to Saigon,
mm-hmm.
and I saw very little of him after that.
Yeah.
Don Luce got to know him in Saigon.
Do you remember his name? Because I was thinking if I talked to Don.
Don. Mr. Dom.
Mr. Dom?
Dom. D-O-M.
Okay.
He then, when Vietnam fell, he was sent to Ban Ma Thuot to look at something in the agricultural ministry, visit offices.
So he was still in the government?
Still, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I guess he was
not
cleared.
Purged.
No,
and,
yeah. He was found to be not guilty of whatever they were accusing him of.
Mm-hmm.
And when he went to Ban Ma Thuot, he was there when the Viet Minh came down and took Ban Ma Thuot, the beginning of the fall.
Oh, you're talking 75 now. Okay.
Yeah, 1975.
Mm-hmm.
So his wife, and I don't know how many of the children, left Saigon in a boat,
uh-huh.
boat people, and went to, I think it was Guam, might have been the Philippines.
Uh-huh.
And she wrote me a letter from there that her husband is dead, that he was killed in Ban Ma Thuot, and he and the children are, I guess, at the refugee camp, and is there anything I can do?
Uh-huh.
And I wrote back after thinking about what I can do. And I never got a response. So I don't know what, I didn't know what happened to them until last year when Don Luce told me that he got a letter from Mr. Dom.
Oh, that he didn't die.
You know, it's not Dom. I'm not sure it's Dom. If I was home, I could get the letter.
Huh?
Sorry.
That's okay.
Let's refer to him as Dom.
Okay.
Saw something about IVF and maybe Don Luce in some publication.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually wrote a letter to Don Luce.
Yeah.
And asked about me, and Don Luce called me, and we eventually got to corresponding.
Uh-huh.
The woman and family were sponsored by someone and relocated in Fargo, North Dakota.
Oh.
From South Vietnam, as far as
and
Mr.
Poor thing.
Mr. Dom, he wasn't killed, but he was captured.
Uh-huh.
And he was in re-education camp.
Oh, he was in re-education.
For many, like 12 years, or I don't, a long time. It's all in the correspondence letter.
Wow.
And eventually he got out, and he also escaped. He didn't get a visa. And found his wife in Fargo, North Dakota.
Jeez.
And he was working at, there's a picture he sent of a watering plant at a nursery.
Uh-huh.
He had a couple of jobs. And they were well liked in Fargo. He retired and his wife retired, and they now live in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure why. And their daughter,
yeah, that
well, that's the reason. Their daughter lives in Texas, and she's also contacted me.
Uh-huh.
But I'm glad it's all right.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, one of the things that we've been sort of following up on is if you've been keeping contact with anybody in the past, and you've sort of already covered that, or, you know.
And of course, we're lucky to have Chi here. He's the Chi, who you've spoken to, and I'm sure he told you about his activities now. He does a semester away in Vietnam with the college.
Yeah, with John Summers' program.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and being a short person.
Recording like this.
And then when I play it back with full power, I don't mean arguing, you know. but what, yeah, that must have been an awful time to have to wait and, you know, assume that this friend of yours is dead.
Yeah, yeah.
And then have him virtually come back from life. Yeah, that must have been.
I'm happy, of course.
Oh, that's right. Have you been able to see him?
No, I would like to, and when one of these travels for ASTA brings me out that way, I'm going to try and do it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's something you better not fail to do. I mean, it'll be something like that road not taken. You know, not getting in touch with your friend again. You know, and time does pass. If you had your fraternity brothers here in the room with us, who were talking about IVS, what would you tell them about this job that would have paid them nothing and sent them to some podunk little place?
I said, you dummy, you missed the boat.
Can you say a little bit more than that? How does it really, you know, become some of the best couple of years of your life? What?
Well, first of all, I wasn't, this is detail, not necessarily open, but I was independent, living in a fraternity.
Oh, okay, all right. So,
the guys. All very good friends.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Well, for me, I think it was the right thing to do for them. It may not have been.
Mm-hmm.
I think it broadened, forgive that overused expression, broadened my outlook, broadened my, well, my experience. I never would have had such an experience, mm-hmm. and I'd probably be still maybe in Connecticut selling real estate or something. Not knowing any more than that.
Mm-hmm.
That was the auditor.
Ah. Oh.
Well, I have always been interested in foreign things.
Yeah.
Things unfamiliar, things, other countries, other cultures, and this certainly allowed me to experience that, for instance, in Vietnam, a different array of fruits every month coming into season that I had never even knew existed before. It allowed me to spend a month in Japan during Sakura time for the first vacation.
Oh.
It allowed me the second vacation to fly to Phnom Penh and then fly to Bangkok and then get on a second class train and go down to the Malay Peninsula to Singapore and get on a Dutch boat and go down to Indonesia, stopping at several ports, Jakarta, Surabaya, Semarang, getting off at Bali, coming back overland to Jakarta by bus and train, and I think we even got on a bullock cart.
And
then flying back to Saigon, it allowed me to, at the end of the 2-year tour, to have a Volkswagen, buy a Volkswagen and have it sent to Saigon with 3 other people and drive from Vietnam through Europe over 7 months time, going through 23 countries and 27,000 miles, which I would never have done if I
No.
just hadn't gone with IVS.
Yeah. probably would have been afraid to do it.
Yeah, and not spending more than 25 cents for a night's accommodations until we reach the Mediterranean.
Isn't that a... sure beats the Red Roof, doesn't it? Even if it's not quite as snazzy as the Red Roof. Oh, gosh. Yeah, it's quite an odyssey. Do you relate your IVS experience to your present occupation?
I think it was the beginning of a path that put me from one place to another place to another place, and then here.
What were a couple of those places? Just to.
Well, because I went on this, I went to Vietnam on a deferment, not alternate service, but deferment.
Yeah.
2 years.
Mm-hmm. 2A probably.
Hmm?
2A probably, so, classification, yeah.
But only for 2 years, and then
right.
I was supposed to go back on the draft list
mm-hmm.
after that.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone, in, from Dr. Nofzinger, and anyone had any IVS that don't worry about it. They've never drafted a IVS, a person who's been through IVS. So I never worried about it too much. And details get fuzzy now, but when I got back home, there were, I believe, several letters from my draft board.
And this would have been sometime in 61.
This would have been, yes.
It was a long trip back.
Yes, my deferment was October 60 and was returned home in May of 61.
Mm-hmm.
So I was 7 months as far as my local draft board.
You hadn't reported.
I was supposed to report back, but
yeah.
It never occurred to me.
No.
It never,
come on.
I mean, I hadn't thought about it for 2 years, and this great trip, it just never occurred to me. So they drafted me.
Oh, God.
So I was the first IMES to be drafted.
Oh, no, from group two. How inauspicious.
So that put me in the Army.
Uh-huh.
And this isn't, it may be interesting, but it's not along what I said once, starting from one point to another, because I went to the idea. But I did my basic training, and while I was in basic training, I had this desire, not while I was in basic training, but when I got back from Vietnam, I had a desire to return to Vietnam.
Oh.
So when I was in basic training, I went to the sergeant or the colonel or whoever. I went somewhere and asked, what do I have to do to get to be sent to Vietnam? Now, this was 61, so it wasn't too bad.
It was.
And I thought I could go back and do for the Army what I did for IVS, just be a nice guy. Well, they said, the response was, well, you have to finish your basic training, and then when you get to your next permanent location, then you can put the paperwork in for transfer to wherever.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay. So I finished basic training. I got orders to go to Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, to the Redstone Arsenal for electronics school. I got there. It was the first week. I went to see somebody about being transferred to being sent to Vietnam. And the response was, well, your orders are cut for here. We can't change orders. You have to finish this school, and when you get to your permanent location, then you could put your papers in. He said, but while you're here, you could take the language test, and if you pass that, you could take the Vietnamese language test. There's a general linguistics test.
Yeah.
You could take that and then take the Vietnamese language test.
If you pass.
I could take it, and yeah, if you pass the aptitude.
Then you'll get onto the specific.
Yeah. So I said, hey, that's a good idea. So I took them and I passed both of them.
Yeah.
So I had now an MOS. You know what an MOS is?
No.
When you're in the Army, you have an MOS, and I don't know what MOS means, but it's a numeric code that refers to the job you do. If you're a cook, your MOS is 179.4. If you're a pastry cook, it's 0.4. If you're a short order cook, it's 0.5, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a plumber, if you're a mechanic on automobiles,
mm-hmm.
it's something else.
Mm-hmm.
My But anyway, I got an MOS for that particular job, .113 for language, 92 for Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that, that was now added to my MOS.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so I finished electronic school, and then I got new orders to go to, the New Jersey was Fort Monmouth, New Jersey.
Okay.
That was electronic school. Then the next orders were to Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville, Alabama.
Oh.
For missile school.
Hmm. Another school.
Another school.
Huh.
So I got to Redstone Arsenal and I said, I'd like to volunteer to go to Vietnam. I have it on my MOS. The response was, your orders are cut for here. You have to finish this school. However, when you finish this school, you will be trained as an internal guidance repairman for the Nike Hercules, Nike Ajax missile system, of which there are none in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they're not going to send you to Vietnam because you want to go.
If they
need your job,
mm-hmm,
somewhere, then if there's a good marriage, okay. But they're not going to do you a favor.
So
by this time, I was a year in the Army, and I said I can do the rest of the year, stand on my head, forget about being told to Vietnam. Then I was sent to permanent, now this is supposed to be the permanent base, Fort Bliss, Texas, El Paso, Texas, out in the desert.
Yeah, I know.
I was there about 2 months. I had enrolled, I figured, you know, Juarez was the city across the border.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it might be a good time to learn Spanish.
Spanish, sure.
So
yeah.
I enrolled in an Army Spanish course.
Mm-hmm.
2 months, Kennedy got on the television about the Cuban Missile Crisis,
mm-hmm,
and the next day we were loading all our equipment onto flatbed trains, and we went to southern Florida,
mm-hmm,
homestead area. The train pulled in at Homestead. We bivouacked on the homestead field, and in about a had field mess and field showers every day. And then they found us an avocado packing warehouse to set up in, and we set up the missiles in the four sites. One in Miami Dump, one in the Everglades, and one in the tomato field.
These were Nike?
Nike Hercules.
Yeah.
Aimed at the...
But Nike Hercules, weren't they for intercepting of...
You're right.
Of bombers?
You're smart. You're right. But they were...
They wouldn't do anything against the guy with a missile.
They were adopted surface to surface. They were originally...
Oh, really?
Originally conceived for surface to air.
Right.
Like you said,
yeah.
But they were modified for surface.
I didn't know they could do that.
I didn't either.
Hmm. And hope, but they wouldn't have delivered much of a payload.
But it was the only missiles we had
in that kind of operation.
In Florida to counter what they had in the, they could probably mess up their missile sites.
Yeah, with direct hits. But who knows? You know, if there's just something that's been jerry-rigged. that would have been, well, we were really unprepared, weren't we, about that particular point.
Yes, we were.
Yeah.
And then I got discharged.
Mm-hmm.
And I went home. And I contacted AID.
Ah, yeah, good move.
If they wanted anybody else to go back to Vietnam. And got accepted, packed my bags, came to D.C. for orientation, and this was for provincial representatives.
Yeah.
And the orientation was reading through files on people who were there or reports they sent back. And I didn't like what they were doing, and I didn't like what I would be doing, what I thought I'd be doing, because it wasn't what I was doing before, which pie in the sky, I thought I'd just go back and, you know, fit in the same type of stuff.
Yeah, well, what were they going to have you do?
Provincial, working at a provincial level.
Uh-huh.
Spying on province chiefs, keeping track of weapons, logistics of supplies coming in and what was done with them and that sort of thing. I let it be known that I have a second thought and they said it'll take a couple of days to think about it.
Uh-huh.
So I went back home, very disenchanted.
Yeah.
And disappointed. And I got home, and there was a letter waiting for me from Penn State University, where I had applied for graduate school back when I was in my senior year at Connecticut.
4 years or more later? 5 years almost.
Because I had, when I was in the Army.
That's really slow mail.
No, that was the date, but I had applied back then.
Uh-huh.
And this piece of mail was recent concerning the scholarship graduate work. Because I had made contact there, would a scholarship still be available if I could get early out of the Army?
Oh,
they,
okay.
They were giving early outs if you go to school.
Okay.
And they, I don't know what happened, but I didn't get an early out. But anyway, this letter, when I got back to Norwalk, said in effect, are you still interested in coming here? Because we have this scholarship. If you're not interested, we'll give it to someone else.
Yeah. Whoa.
So I said, well, let me come right out and see what you look like. You know, I've never been there.
Uh-huh.
I picked Penn State, like I picked Connecticut. It's just the name fancied me or something. So I went out there, and I ended up going to graduate school there.
Mm-hmm.
Went to graduate school there, and during the, I spent too long there, 4 years. I was working at plant breeding, going into plant breeding, and I just couldn't get the interspecific cross, so I just try again and try again. But anyway, the executive vice president from this association, American Seed Trade Association, at that time, 1967, was up to Penn State to talk to the Pennsylvania Seedmen's Association, a meeting there.
Uh-huh.
And the head of the department, he talked to the head of the department saying that he was going to add a position to the staff here. At that time, there were only two people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there were two secretaries. So Darrell Walker, the head of the department, he was probably thinking it was time for me to move on anyway, asked me if I would be interested in this job at the Seed Trade Association. And I had interviewed two, three seed companies and hadn't gotten any good vibrations back. So I was looking for something to do too. And I said, yeah, I would be interested. So one thing led to the other, I came to Washington to ASTI. I thought it'd be interesting to live in a big city and work here for 2 years. And here it's 28.
28 years later.
So that's more or less
that's IBS. That's a, okay. Yeah. What is actually your position in that?
I'm vice president for programs and services.
Uh-huh.
And earlier we talked about what ASTA is.
And the international
and the legislative. And the third major prong is the meetings that we put on for our members. We have an annual convention that I referred to earlier.
Yeah, and you've got to do all the paperwork
and
follow up on
all the detail work beforehand.
Yeah, and now
all the planning and how many chairs to set in the room and what style, whether it's conference style or theater style or school style or how big the head table is to be and whether they're going to have refreshments or not. And we have six commodity divisions in the association. We categorize our groupings of seed. One is corn and sorghum, that's a division. Another is farm seed, which is the grasses and legumes and small grains. Vegetable and flower seed division, home garden division, lawn seed division. I guess that'll come out, but I don't know where it is. And each of those has a conference sometime in the year.
Oh, so you're really busy.
Our largest is 2,400 people.
Mm-hmm.
Held in Chicago each year, corn and sorghum and soybean division are back to back. Our smallest is executive committee meeting, 50 people. And I'm also secretary of the National Council of Commercial Plant Breeders, the only staff person for that, and secretary of the American Seed Research Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And that foundation funds research at most of land-grant universities on seed-specific projects.
Is that your niche? Really?
I hope.
Yeah. No, I should say, sounds like it to me.
Getting ready to retire.
Yeah, well, it may be time, 28 years. But anyway, I think it's probably time to retire the tape because you've got a little follow-up work to do in the last convention. But I do thank you for taking the time.
I've enjoyed it.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah, okay, good. And
it,
I have,
it,
okay,
it re,
better,
yeah.
What's that?
It rekindles some memories. I mean, I when you asked me what was my favorite story, I couldn't think of one, and I think I came up with three or something.
Yeah.
And tigers.
And bears, oh my.
And it's amazing. Bears?
No, I'm just, lions and tigers and bears.
But it was amazing, and I don't know how many tigers were left in Vietnam, but it was not unusual to hear, where I was, to hear tigers at night.
I was going to ask you on that.
There were, they would set these traps on the plantations, and they would catch tigers, and I'd just pass by, and there's this tiger sitting in this cage, and I don't know if they, you know, they could, if anybody wants to buy it, they could buy it, or they'd probably eventually kill it and, you know, sell the claws and the whiskers and the teeth and that sort of thing, and the pelt. And elephants, there were all these. I could every once in a while find elephant droppings very near the vegetable farm.
But then they didn't like to eat vegetables.
They wouldn't give them that.
You wouldn't have had the owl. Yeah, I better turn this thing off here.